Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's show, all the lonely people. Christmas is traditionally a time for getting together with our families. But let's spare a thought for the plight of the surprisingly large number of lonely people who have nobody with whom to spend the festive season. Spotlight on Christmas cribs. Just how did the tradition of making nativity scenes come about? And where can you find a relic of the Christ Child's crib in Rome? And all about the Advent wreath. Scottish Jesuit priest Chris Bowles looks at the tradition of Advent wreaths and explores their symbolism.
All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
Christmas is drawing near, and it's a time that we traditionally celebrate in the company of our families. But what about those people who have nobody with whom to spend the festive season? As I've been finding out, there are more and more lonely people in Britain today, not just at Christmas, but throughout the whole year. We are living longer, and increasingly, we are living alone. Statistics predict that by the year 2020, more than 2 out of 3 British households will be people living on their own. It's estimated that already 1 million elderly people in the nation don't see a friend or a neighbour during the course of an average week. But whilst most of those suffering from loneliness do tend to be the elderly, observers say more and more people from all age groups and all social milieu are falling into this category. But why is there so much loneliness in today's society? And how is the Church reaching out to offer comfort and companionship to these isolated people? Siobhan Garibaldi is a trustee of the St. Vincent de Paul Society in London, and as a volunteer, often visits lonely people in their homes.
Well, I think that loneliness goes across the age range, from children being left to their own devices while their parents go to work, to the elderly whose family are nowhere near or too busy coping with their own lives to help. It goes across the social scale, from the materially poor to the well-off. And it also goes across all nationalities, from our own indigenous population to the thousands of immigrants pouring into the country, many of whom have left their families behind in their quest for work. I think that the breakdown of the family unit, with many, many marriage breakups, causes an awful lot of single parents to feel in a position of loneliness as they struggle to make ends meet and haven't got the time or the money to go out and make social visits. So it's very much across the board, and I think there are many contributing factors as to why loneliness is so prevalent today.
Monsignor John Furnival is a parish priest in the Liverpool area. And he agrees with Siobhan that it's not just old people who suffer from loneliness and isolation.
I think actually more and more it's not just confined to the elderly. It is very much those who are on the younger age bracket and perhaps people who are out of work, people who have been put out of their own home, people of that kind who would, you know, come into the younger age bracket. So it is a problem amongst younger people too, where perhaps there's disillusionment and alienation from their own families.
It's a widely held assumption that those suffering from loneliness are usually poverty-stricken. But as Siobhan makes clear, these people are quite often materially well off.
If somebody needs a visit, hopefully we're there to make that visit and to befriend them. That does go right across the economic scale. People who are well off can also be lonely because their families are busy in their day-to-day lives. I think we live in a 24-hour culture where people are racing about, not just during the day now, but also in the evening and during the night. Many people work shifts. And that affects people who have got money and also people who haven't got money. I think everybody at the end of the day is suffering because of our 21st century living.
Material well-being, though, is no substitute for the companionship of family and friends, and it's little wonder that people living on their own are more likely to fall prey to feelings of depression and anxiety. Monsignor Furnival says that many of the lonely people he visits in his parish are severely depressed.
I think at times morale can be very low. I visit a lady whose husband has gone into a geriatric unit who's suffering from Alzheimer's. And they were together for 60 years and now have to be apart. And I think it's a heartbreak for her, for the wife, because the husband is not really conscious of the separation, but she's very acutely conscious of it, is in her own home, very lonely, and she often phones me simply to have a voice at the other end of the phone and a break in the, you know, what is for her a very long day and a very tearful day, I suspect. So there are people like that who've been separated on health grounds and so on. And I think that would be, you know, one that I'd single out amongst a number of others, really, in that situation. People who have spent their lives together and now forcibly separated, unfortunately.
It can be depressing sitting at home by yourself. But even going out and about can be just as bad sometimes, because it shows up the contrast with the lives of other people, as Siobhan explains.
It's very easy when you're living on your own to feel depressed. Even when you're not actually in the house yourself, you don't have to be in a quiet environment to feel depressed. I think something that exacerbates the problem greatly is the fact that if you do go out and about, everybody around and about seems to be having, you know, a good time, particularly when you see people out in groups and you yourself are out and you're on your own. I think it makes the problem feel worse, and I think that you do tend to feel more depressed.
These feelings of depression among the lonely have been so severe that sometimes people have been tempted to consider committing suicide. Siobhan again.
Personally, I have come across people who have been contemplating suicide because the problems that they have, some people may have mental health problems, they may have physical problems, and if they feel that they have nobody to share that with, they do sometimes wonder what the point of carrying on is. Now, when we're on the end of the telephone, or when we're there to go around and make a visit and to talk it through with them and give them some degree of hope, that there is hope on the horizon and there is a reason to carry on with their life. Hopefully that doesn't make a difference and turn the situation around. But I personally have come across people on several occasions that have been contemplating suicide because life does seem so dark for them. And around and about, particularly if you watch the television, it gives the impression that everybody else is having a jolly good time.
When people slide into despair like this, Siobhan says she and other volunteers can help pull them back from the brink by offering their hand in friendship.
If we're able to spend time talking to somebody just to make them realise that life is worth living, then in their moment of despair, I think they feel that there is a glimmer of hope. We're not experts in anything in particular. What we are able to give is our time and our compassion and our commitment to people. And even though we're not experts, just being a fellow human being, sitting down and taking the time to talk to them and to offer the hand of friendship and to reach out to them in their moment of need, hopefully will do the trick and actually make them feel that life is worth carrying on with.
And he wanders home alone. So how can you tell me you're lonely?
Don't say for you. Not surprisingly, it's all too common for people living on their own to seek out companionship via the TV or even the internet. But as Monsignor Furnival explains, this can be a dangerous strategy.
Yes, if people are on the internet, I think that does become quite a feature of life, and television certainly dominates. But I think that ultimately, if that is their only diet, they lose the social skills. They lose the, you know, ability to interact and relate to others. I think this is where the church comes in, really, in terms of the local parish community, trying to reach out to people like that, bring them back in, invite them to coffee mornings, as we do regularly for the bereaved, for example, and for those living alone, to relate them back to the community, because I think that's the great tragedy of the television, the internet taking over people's lives. And it could do so for a whole vast range of people, and they lose that community sense, that sense of belonging, really, and become very isolated.
Siobhan agrees with him and told me that sometimes the TV and computer can encourage lonely people to lose track of reality.
The television now is available 24 hours a day, and I have known cases where people who have no other reason to get up will stay up by night watching television and sleep by day because of our 24-hour culture. People who don't work, who perhaps have been alienated by the rest of society, live in their homes and quite often only have the television to try and keep them company. I dealt with one case myself where a gentleman called Phil, who was a recovering alcoholic, was moved from a rehabilitation unit into his own accommodation, and he'd already alienated his family and friends because of his alcohol problem, and he was unemployable due to physical and mental problems. So because he was unable to drive and he had mobility problems, he was a virtual prisoner in his own home. Now, in that situation, day tends to merge into night. And we found with Phil that he was staying up during the night to watch television and then would sleep during the day, that his week had no structure, whereas we tend to live between Monday and Friday in a working environment and then use our leisure time at the weekend. For Phil, there was no weekend. One day was much the same as the next. Day was much the same as night. So what we were able to do was to go in and visit him, to take him out of his home so that he could see the outside world, so that he could have some structure in his life and look forward to our visit. And it was a time when he was able to sit down and chat to us and tell him about his experience in life. And he had an awful lot to say and an awful lot to give. And at the end of the day, we learn from our visits as well. We end up wiser and hopefully a little bit better by making the visits ourselves. It's a two-way process.
Christmas, as we all know, is a time of goodwill and fellowship that we traditionally spend with our families. But for those living on their own, it can be a season to dread, when those feelings of loneliness become even more acute.
Yes, I think the sense of isolation increases at Christmas because people look around, they see perhaps people going to parties, office parties, they see activity, they see consumerism in the shops, and they may not be able to access all that. And I think it must be an increasingly sad time, Christmas time, when there's an acute sense of that. Loss of a sense of belonging, really, at a time when ostensibly we should be very much emphasizing belonging and community, and the whole spirit of the Christmas message is to care for everybody. And I think the sense of need is so great at Christmas time.
And as Siobhan points out, there are far more people than we think who are forced to spend Christmas on their own.
There's many cases that we've dealt with where people might otherwise be totally on their own at Christmas. There was one particular case called Dorothy, and the St. Vincent de Paul Society members went out to visit Dorothy and to befriend her and to sit down and spend time with her. And it transpired that when Dorothy died, that we had actually been the only people to visit her. And there's many thousands of people like Dorothy who sit on their own all the time, and Christmas just exacerbates the feeling of loneliness that everybody else is together with their family and they're on their own.
In the all-night cafe at 11:15, same old man sitting there on his own.
I was speaking to Siobhan Garibaldi of the St. Vincent de Paul Society in London, and Monsignor John Furnival, a parish priest in the Liverpool area.
So how can you tell me you're lonely?
don't say for you that the sun don't shine. Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. Show you something to make you change your mind.
Christmas and crib scenes go together. But when and how did the tradition of making nativity scenes come about? And in which Roman basilica can you find a relic of the Christchild's crib? Tracy McClure tells us more in this special report.
Christmas is in the air here in Rome. A towering Christmas tree stands near the center of St. Peter's Square, and carpenters and technicians are busy putting the finishing touches to a bigger-than-life nativity scene embraced by the Basilica's colonnade. Though the nativity won't be unveiled until Christmas Eve, you can already catch a glimpse of buildings that form the backdrop for the Christ child's birth in a humble stable. Well, all across Italy, in churches and piazzas and in homes, nativity scenes, or presepe as they're called here, have been set up to recall the humble birth of the Savior. Naples has for centuries been the capital of nativity scene making here in Italy, with craftsmen creating elaborate figures, animals, and entire villages out of clay and papier-mâché. Pictures and paintings of the Nativity have been around since the very first Christians used them to record Christ's coming. But the tradition of making a three-dimensional presepe dates back to the time of St. Francis of Assisi, who is credited with making the first live Nativity scene on a hillside in Umbria, Italy, around the year 1220. Well, I sat down with Elizabeth Lev, professor of Christian art and architecture with Duquesne University, for a fireside chat about the origins of nativity scenes and where some of the most interesting can be found here in Rome.
The first nativity scene as we know it with the different figures was created in 1223 by St. Francis of Assisi in a little town called Greccio, except he wasn't using little plastic figurines. He had people dressed up as Mary and Joseph and the shepherds, and he had them come out and arrange themselves like a little theater piece in front of a gathered crowd so that people would understand the humility of Christ's birth. Francis had a tremendous devotion to the nativity of Christ, but particularly the humility of the humility of the way Christ came into the world. And so if you imagine Umbria, which is, you know, a hilly place, it gets pretty darn cold, these people standing out there shivering, you know, waiting for this baby to come into the world, it's a better way for people to understand the hardship that Mary and Joseph went through in order to bring God into the world, and that the extraordinary sacrifice from the very beginning on the part of God to not be brought into the world in a nice, comfortable hospital bed with all the things that blip and whir, not in a nice, warm, comfortable room with beds and blankets, but on the ground in the cold, very vulnerable.
And of course, since the 1200s and that very first nativity scene, it's exploded, really, the practice amongst Christians, Catholics in particular, to have nativity scenes in their homes at Christmas time. When I take my kids to church for the children's mass for Christmas, they reenact mm-hmm. the birth of the baby Jesus in the stable in Bethlehem.
It's a very good custom also for people to understand the idea of waiting. Not only was there the custom of putting out a nativity scene in expectation of the birth of Christ, but there used to be figurines put into churches for the period of Lent, these two great periods of the year when Christians prepare themselves. At the time of St. Francis, the period of Advent was seen as a time of purification, of sort of a penitential time with fasting and purification of oneself and activities of repentance in order to be ready at the day the moment came. And those that preparation of putting out the figures of Mary and Joseph, putting the empty manger there that you wait and wait and wait, the sight of the kings who are coming from afar to bring gifts, and you think to yourself, what gift shall I bring? Which of course is yourself. So it's a very, very good and beautiful tradition. The tradition was then picked up in Rome very shortly thereafter with one of the earliest, we have no way of knowing if indeed it's the earliest, but one of the earliest nativity sets is from 1290, and it's contained in St. Mary Major's Basilica here in Rome, and it was made by Arnolfo di Cambio, who was the greatest of the sculptors of his era. He's a contemporary with Giotto, with Pietro Cavallini, and Arnolfo di Cambio, architect, sculptor, was called down by Nicholas IV, who was a Franciscan pope. So continuing the devotion of Francis into the Nativity, he hired a magnificent artist to create the figures of Mary and Joseph and Jesus and the ox and the ass, and they're contained in this church. There's actually a special chapel to them.
I'm not familiar with that one. Is it a colored wooden statue?
What
is
no, it exactly? it's a stone. It's mm-hmm. a stone statue, mm-hmm. and if you, it's hard to see because they've been taken out of the public. They were taken out of the public view for many years, but then they were moved into the museum of the church, so they are visible to the public. But they were kept for many, many, many years in the chapel, which was built by Pope Sixtus V. And so what everybody sees is the huge ciborium, because it was the adoration chapel for the Blessed Sacrament. But underneath, you can see there's a confessio kind of space underneath, and inside there is a chapel with a little room where the figures used to be. And that's on top of an older room that was part of the older church where Nicholas IV originally put the figures.
And of course, you mentioned St. Mary Major. That's, of course, also the basilica, which has a piece of the relic of the actual crib of the baby Jesus.
One of the names of St. Mary Major is Santa Maria Presepe, Mary of the Manger. And so it alludes to the relic in that church for centuries and centuries and centuries. And as a matter of fact, St. Mary Major was the station church for the Pope. So in the earliest years of the church, the Pope went to St. Mary Major in order to celebrate the birth of our Lord. Then with the arrival of the relic of the crib, it became even more consolidated with that site of Mary, who indeed the church is built to celebrate Mary, Mother of God.
I've seen the reliquary there in the museum of St. Mary Major. They had it was a big golden looking.
That's the earlier reliquary. And there is actually another more modern reliquary, which was made in the 19th century by Valadier. It was a royal gift, and it was a crystal urn with silver design around it, and the crystal is transparent so that you can look in and see the slats of wood of the crib.
So where is it physically now?
It's today? Physically in the confessio. So mm-hmm. again, in that confessio you can actually go down. You can head down the stairs and then you stand right in front of the big open area and you see this crystal urn. You look through and you see these simple, darkened, humble pieces of wood. And then if you look in back of you, you see the statue of Pope Pius IX, who is kneeling in prayer before the relic of the crib. So really a lovely reminder of the papacy's own devotion to the Nativity.
And of course, if you go down the stairs into the confessio, it brings immediately to mind the image of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, mm-hmm. where you have to go down the few stairs to get into the grotto there, mm-hmm. where Christ was born. You see the star on the actual pavement where the crib used to be.
Excellent, excellent comparison. Really nice image, that this idea of traveling downwards, looking and back in time to that humble, humble spot where the foundation of the church was born.
Is there anything special that happens at St. Mary Major at the time of Christmas?
Well, St. Mary Major always has the most beautiful, most packed masses. It always uses the time of Advent. The St. Mary Major always, as a form of preparation for Advent, they hold a series of concerts, very beautiful sacred music concerts. So these each week, another beautiful piece of music in preparation for the arrival of Christmas.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Lev, professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus.
Made of evergreen plants and with four candles, the Advent wreath is a long-standing Christian tradition that is used as a spiritual preparation for the coming of Christmas. Scottish Jesuit priest Chris Bowles reflects on this traditional practice and explores its symbolism.
In many churches and houses all over the world, we find a very special Advent feature, known by various names, but most commonly, I suppose, as the Advent wreath. Wreaths are popular and easy to make, and they bring the specialness of Advent right into the heart of the house or the church. They're not only easy to make, but they're full of symbol and imagery too. Advent wreaths tell a great story without the need of words. The wreath is usually made from evergreens, which are a family of very special plants. Evergreens, such as pines or hollies, somehow remain alive and budding even when all the other plants around seem to have died for the winter. The symbolism here reminds us that God is always with us and will never change, will never leave us, will never be absent. Another symbol concerning the wreath is the fact that it's usually round, taking the form of a circle. Here's another representation of God, who is without beginning and without end. So the wreath speaks to us of God who is eternal. They may be simple or they may be elaborately decorated, but usually in most wreaths, candles make up the central focus. They usually have three purple candles and a pink one, and we build the lights up through the four Sundays of Advent. We light one on the first Sunday, two on the second, and so on. In terms of symbols, the use of light in churches is pretty obvious. Candles remind us that Jesus is the light of the world. We light candles on the altar when we celebrate Mass. A candle remains always lit to remind us that Christ is present in the tabernacle. In Advent, though, as I've said, we light an additional candle for each week of the season. We do this to symbolize that the day of Christ's birth is coming closer. It tells us that the light is getting nearer, and what's more, the brightness of the light of Christ is gathering more and more, and darkness is dispelled. There's a lovely English language Advent song entitled Come, O Divine Messiah, which has a particular line that implores God, saying, dispel the night and show thy face and bid us hail the dawn of grace. With the Advent candles, we do exactly this. We dispel the night and bring in the light. Come the dawn, we don't need our candles anymore. So the wreath reminds us it's only a time of waiting, and waiting always gives way to something better. Well, maybe not always. I remember long ago reading a novel by the author Laurie Lee entitled Cider with Rosie. In the novel, Lee describes his first day in school in the Cotswold village in England where he grew up. He got to school and there weren't enough desks, so the teacher told him to stand in the corner for the present. He willingly and excitedly did so, thinking he would get a present at the end of the wait. Maybe for him, the waiting didn't give way to something better. But it certainly does for us.
That reflection came from Father Chris Bowles, a Scottish Jesuit priest. And that concludes today's broadcast. Thanks so much for joining me, Susie Hodges, here on Vatican Radio. Until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.